From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The poor and the politicians. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Great Recession officially ended last year, but 44 million Americans were living below the poverty line, one person in seven, the highest rate since 1994. The rates for children, blacks, and Hispanics were higher still, and they would have been worse except for various government safety nets. Food banks, shelters, and job opportunity centers around the country tell us they're serving a new and different class of people, the recently unemployed. What's the reaction in Washington 6 weeks before the November elections? Will the private sector start hiring, or should government create new jobs? On Reporter's Notebook later on, new help for buried miners in Chile. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. Poverty in America increased last year to 44 million people. One longtime advocate calls it a national emergency. Will Washington treat it that way? How many poor people vote? On Reporter's Notebook, a massive oil company drill may be able to help rescue Chilean miners trapped 2,000 feet underground for the past 6 weeks. First, this news update. Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is in New York for the opening of the UN General Assembly, saying that this weekend's release of Shehra Shurd should be met by what he called a comparable humanitarian gesture by the United States. Shurd is one of three Americans arrested last year and charged with spying near the Iraq-Iran border. The U.S. is holding several Iranians on various charges. Here's Sarah Shurd.
My gratitude goes in particular to Ayatollah Khamenei and President Ahmadinejad for my compassionate release from detention. It is my deepest hope that the world will not let this humanitarian gesture by the Iranian government and judicial branch go unrecognized.
Sarah Shurd, of course, also playing for Iran to release her fiancé and another man with whom she was arrested. Reza Aslan is a columnist for The Daily Beast and author of No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. Always glad to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me back.
She said that, and obviously an attempt to get another humanitarian gesture from Iran. Ahmadinejad comes back and says, wait a minute, we're talking about humanitarian gestures here. What about the Iranians being held captive by the United States?
Yeah, I think in some ways Ahmadinejad tipped his hand. A lot of people have been saying that the reason that the Iranians have been holding these three young people for more than a year now on what seem fairly clearly trumped up charges of spying. I mean, it's fairly clear, I think, for anyone who's looked at this case that these are just kids who ended up in the wrong place at the wrong time, is that he's hoping for some sort of bargaining chip. And he made that very clear when he said that, you know, he's hoping that the United States will, quote unquote, return the gesture by releasing a group of Iranians who are being held in U.S. custody. Well, we don't know too much about these Iranians, why they're being held or what the situation is or whether they're being held in the United States or whether they're being held in Iraq or not. But it does seem pretty clear that Ahmadinejad wants to make a deal.
I suppose by not revealing more about why the Iranians are being held, the United States makes it sort of difficult to criticize Ahmadinejad.
He does. And of course, what he's doing is sending a veiled message to the Obama administration. Now, I've sort of been digging around a little bit about this issue, and I'm fairly certain what he's referring to is a group of Iranian diplomats who were arrested in Iraq a couple of years ago on charges of either spying on behalf of the Iranian government or perhaps interfering with the coalition activities. Hard to say, of course, as you can imagine, everything that's going on in Iraq, but that's clearly what Ahmadinejad is trying to do.
How strong is Ahmadinejad in his own country? He said originally that he was going to release Sarah Shurd at a certain date. The courts in Iran said, wait a minute, you got to wait longer than that. We haven't been heard from yet. Then they finally went along. That was interpreted, as I understand it, as kind of a slap at him.
Very much so. And in fact, despite the sort of confidence and bluster that he has been showing on the international stage, the truth of the matter is that Iran is quite a fractured political situation right now, in particular amongst the conservatives. The conservatives in Iran are actually a diverse set of groups, from sort of centrists and pragmatists to the military and hardline nationalists and even hardline religious conservatives. And while over the last year they were able to do away with their differences and come together and unite against what they saw as a common enemy, that is the Green Movement, now that that movement has been more or less silenced, at least the disturbances on the street have been more or less silenced, some of those fractures are starting to come to the surface. And there is talk amongst Ahmadinejad's supporters, former supporters, I should say, in the parliament of impeaching him for his poor economic performance. And there's talk amongst the religious elite about Ahmadinejad essentially pushing the clerics out of influence and out of a political power. So there's a lot going on in Iran under the surface, and it is sometimes difficult to read the tea leaves, but you're right. In the back and forth about Sarah's release, we saw some of that come to the surface.
Very quickly, she has asked to meet with him and, of course, plead for the release of her comrades. Would it be in his interest to do that?
Well, it's in his interest insofar as he is a bit of a megalomaniac who enjoys the international spotlight. He is, after all, been requesting for the last couple of years what he refers to as a man-to-man debate between he and President Obama. So I think for the news cameras, it's something that he might consider. Whether it actually plays a role in the release of Sarah's friends who are still trapped in Iran, that remains to be seen.
Hard, I suppose, for him to continue to hold them if she makes the kind of personal appeal that she seems quite capable of doing. She looked pretty good at her news conference. Reza Aslan, it's always good to have you on our program, and thanks a lot for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Again, columnist for The Daily Beast, author of No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. In a moment, the poor and the politicians on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. The National Bureau of Economic Research academic scholar said today, the Great Recession that started in December of 2007 officially ended in June of last year. But don't tell that to the 43.6 million people who are trying to live below the poverty line. That's 14.3% of Americans overall, or 1 in 7. It includes 20% of all children, 25% of blacks and Hispanics. That's the highest poverty rate since 1994, and the Census Bureau says it would have been worse except for government safety nets. Deborah Weinstein calls it a national emergency. She is executive director of the Coalition on Human Needs in Washington. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
First of all, how do we define a poverty? What does it mean?
Well, the Census Bureau has figures below which, if you're living on that much money, you're considered poor. So for a family of four people, it's a little less than $22,000, or at least that's what it was in 2009, and that's when these figures are from. And they adjust that number for family size. For one person, it's about $11,000.
Okay. Why do you call this a national emergency? The increase, I think, since 2008 was a few million people, a relatively small percentage, maybe 4 or 5%, something like that.
Well, it's a large percentage historically. An additional 3.7 million more poor people in just 1 year. That's on top of a growth of 2.5 million people the year before. So we're having a tremendous surge in poverty. Certain groups are very disproportionately poor. More than 1 in 5 children is poor, for instance. And if you look at black children or African Americans in general, other minority groups, they are extraordinarily poor. So more than 1 in 4 African Americans are poor. More than a third of all black children and are poor. Similar numbers for Hispanic children. But poverty is high for all children, and so we're talking about vulnerable groups, hugely high percentages, and we need to be aware that that poverty is going to have consequences as children grow up, perhaps lifelong consequences.
Elaborate a bit on what you mean by that.
We know that poor children are more likely to have inadequate nutrition, and that can delay their development, cause them not to do as well in school, fall behind in school, be more likely to be sick. All of these things threaten their ability to do well in their whole lives, which is a moral wrong for us in this very wealthy nation, but it also has practical consequences. You're talking about so many children in this country, they're going to grow up not to be as productive parts of our workforce, and that means our economy will suffer. So it has huge consequences for children, but it has consequences for all of us. We cannot waste the human resources of this high level of poverty.
Is this something that has been true in the United States throughout its history, that it's had a very substantial number of poor people?
It certainly has varied. Right now, we've been on an upward trend for a number of years. But, for instance, during the 1990s, when our economy was doing very well and the prosperity we had was more shared, poverty was lower at that time. We know that when we take steps to encourage work, make it easier for people to find work, and supplement low wages, that we can really do a great deal towards reducing poverty.
Again, Deborah Weinstein is Executive Director of the Coalition on Human Needs in Washington. Jason Perkins Cohen is Executive Director of the Job Opportunities Task Force in Baltimore, Maryland. That's a group that works to increase the skills and job opportunities and incomes of low-skill, low-income workers and job seekers as well. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us to what extent things have changed for you over the past couple of years. Are you seeing a different population of people now than you did before the Great Recession?
We really are. I think we're seeing two things. First of all, we're just seeing huge numbers of people, more than we've ever seen before in terms of the demand for training and the demand for job assistance and placement assistance. And then I think we're also seeing, unfortunately, a lot more desperation in the people who enter our training programs and then ask for help, where they're just in much more desperate straits and don't know where else to turn. And then the second thing I think we're seeing is the sort of the characteristics of the demographics of the people. Not only are we seeing the people who don't have a lot of work experience, those are the people we've seen in the past. Now we're seeing people who actually have quite a bit of work experience and sometimes at a high level of assistance who don't have experience being unemployed, never thought they would come having to look for help for training or for job placement assistance, and have tried to do it on their own, have tried to do it through their networks, which has always worked for them in the past, and it's just not working in this economic climate, so they're coming to us.
What are you able to do for them?
Well, I think what we're able to do for them to the best we can is to use the training programs both that we offer and that the other our partners offer to get them back on their feet as quickly as we can in terms of retraining, about thinking about what skills they do have to offer and how to get them back in the market. I mean, I think the worst thing for anyone is generally to be disconnected from the labor force for all kinds of reasons. And one is just sort of continuing to build networks and to continue to obtain skills. So we try and get people back in, earning a wage as quickly as possible to get their head above water, and then to think about other ways in which they can make themselves more attractive to potential employers.
What about young people, especially recent graduates from high school and college?
Yeah, so they're specifically disadvantaged because, as we all know, with so many people unemployed, and unable to find any other types of work. I think one of the other things that we're seeing is what's making it harder for people who have younger people who don't have as much experience or other people who have other challenges is that they're crowded out even more than ever from the job market. So they're competing for jobs with people who are overqualified and people who are taking jobs that they ordinarily would not take because they're overqualified. Now they're taking these jobs, and then the jobs that a younger person might be able to obtain based on their skill level, they can't get.
Jason Perkins-Cohen again at the Job Opportunities Task Force in Baltimore. Reverend Frank Spencer is Executive Director of Stewpot Community Services, provides food, clothing, shelter to the poor and the homeless in Jackson, Mississippi, the poorest state in the country. Reverend Spencer, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us how things have changed for you.
Well, they began changing really about 2.5 years ago, and we started seeing increases in the people that came to lunch with us, and also in the food pantry where we give out canned foods to people that need it.
So you have seen an increase in people. Are you also seeing a different kind of people?
One of the things that my staff tells me is the frequent comments of people that come in and say, "I never thought I'd be coming here for food."
How do you deal with that? Do you have sufficient food to provide for greater numbers? Are you able to get the kinds of donations you need?
Well, we're not able to get the kind of donations. We started off slow last year, and we're starting off slow this year. Now, fortunately, at the end of the year, the individual donations caught up to where they were the previous year, but we're still a couple of months away from that increase. Fundraising, our main problem has been in grants. The grants aren't available as they used to be, both federal government and company grants to help subsidize the services that we provide here.
You also have shelters, do you not? Are you able to keep them open?
We had to close one shelter last year because the unavailability of grants to run it, and we had to shut down a day shelter because we couldn't get grants to support it. Previously, those programs had been supported by contributions, but also by grants from local agencies and the government.
So you got more people to deal with, people who never thought they were going to be there, and yet fewer resources to deal with them?
Exactly.
Reverend Frank Spencer at the Stewpot Community Services in Jackson, Mississippi. Beverly DeMoore is Chief Communications Officer at the St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance in Phoenix, Arizona. It says it's the first food bank ever in the United States. Obviously, there are many of them around the country now. Beverly DeMoore, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Same question to you as I've asked the others. Have things changed, and if so, how much?
They've changed a lot. We actually have doubled in size in the last 2 years. Kind of the food bank metric for size is the number of pounds that you distribute in a year. And this last fiscal year that just ended in June, we distributed 72 million pounds of food.
72 million pounds to how many people?
If you want to kind of take the equation a little bit further, a good balanced meal is about a pound of food. So you can say mm-hmm. we provided enough food into the community to provide about 72 million meals, and that was to about 500,000 people. We distribute through about two-thirds of the state of Arizona.
And do you have the same issue there? Have you had the same experience as the others we've just heard from, that these are a different group of people than you've seen in the past?
Very much so. Very similar stories. In fact, we have a lot of people that have come and said, you know what, we used to donate to you. We used to be a contributor, and now I need your help, and I can't believe I'm here.
People who donated to the food bank are now coming to ask for food.
Yes, exactly.
How many? What kind of numbers?
Again, we have about 500,000 that have been coming directly to us for direct client services. The other way that the food bank gets out the vast majority of its food is actually through other nonprofit partners. So the soup kitchens, the homeless shelters, people that have a food component to what they do come to us to provide that food.
But can you estimate the number of former donors, or is that something anecdotal? You can't really keep track of it.
Exactly. It's anecdotal.
What does the food bank do?
What does the food bank do? This is sort of it might sound a little flippant, but we're almost the Costco to the nonprofit world. So we call ourselves the food guys. We are good at going and getting food that either would have gone to waste, you know, say the dozen eggs that you put back on the shelf because one of them was broken, we'll take it. We also have an expertise in dealing with food producers themselves, who a lot of times, and to their immense credit, especially in these times, will overproduce in order to donate. So we're very good at going out, getting the food, bringing it back, and then distributing it to those who are in need.
Beverly DeMoore in Phoenix. Back to Reverend Spencer in Jackson, Mississippi. Do you have that experience? Are people able to come up with food that would otherwise have been wasted? Do producers, in fact, do a little extra in order to provide help to your people?
We have several producers that have overruns in chicken. We have one producer that produces catfish that's very generous to us. And we have the gleaners here that glean from the food stores and make it available through themselves and also through our local food network.
Ms. DeMoore, back to you. Phoenix is a relatively prosperous city. Why is it the one that's had the first food bank in the United States?
You know, it was the vision of our founder, John Van Hengel, had actually been volunteering, and he got at St. Vincent de Paul and got into a conversation with a woman whose her husband was in jail, and she was feeding three kids. And he said, "How do you do this?" And she said, "How do you make it?" And he said, "Well, I come to places like this, like St. Vincent de Paul, or you'd be amazed at what gets thrown away." So basically she was dumpster diving, and a little bell went off in his head, and he thought, wouldn't it be great if you could go to a place like a bank and withdraw extra food, like you can go to a financial bank and withdraw money that's saved there.
Reverend Spencer, Mississippi has been the poorest state in the union for a long a time. Why do you think that is?
Probably because the level of our education and the fact that with the advent of really the revolution in mechanics, we've lost a lot of people off the farm that provided manual labor. And so they're now jobless. They're gradually moving away, but we stay the lowest paid nation in state in the nation.
Jason Perkins Cohen in Baltimore. That's an old city, and it's had its ups and downs. What's the current situation in Baltimore in general that you think? I guess I'm asking for some context for what you say now are huge numbers of people in great desperation.
Well, I think just like all over the country, I think we're really suffering. I think that in other parts of the state, maybe not as much because we're a little closer to federal government and some of the government positions are still there. But in Baltimore City, like many urban areas, we really struggle with a lot of different barriers, including adult education, where we have one in four adults that don't have a high school diploma or GED, and other barriers that just make it really tough for people. And much like in other parts of the country, in Mississippi and other places where manufacturing has really left the city, it used to be that if you had a high school degree, it was enough to get a decent wage. And we all know that today it's really not. So you have to find a way to not only obtain your high school diploma or GED, but advance and acquire more skills.
Okay, we're going to hear from all of you as our program goes forward. First, we do need to take a brief break. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, we'll hear about new help for those 33 miners that are buried in Chile, have been underground for 6 weeks. There's some hope for them today that wasn't there the day before. Tell us what you think on our To the Point Facebook page. We'll be back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point, talking about increasing poverty figures in the United States. We've talked to people in Baltimore, in Mississippi, and in Phoenix, Arizona, all of whom have said that they have people on the lines now who said they never expected to be asking for work, to be asking for food. In Arizona at the St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance in Phoenix, Beverly DeMoore says that former donors to the food bank are now coming and asking for food. People, again, who say they never expected to be in that position. I want to go back to Deborah Weinstein of the Coalition on Human Needs in Washington. This new poverty rate for last year, higher than the year before, higher than at any time since 1994, hit pretty hard in the news last week. What was the reaction in Washington amongst the politicians there?
Well, there are some who I know are extremely concerned, but we're not at all certain that that level of concern is going to push over the roadblocks that now exist to that actually threaten continuing benefits that and jobs programs that can really make a difference, that are making a difference in keeping millions of people out of poverty. So the question that has to be asked of Congress is, will they act on the recognition that this really is a state of emergency, and that there are a number of things they really must do before they leave and go back to campaigning?
Very quickly, can you give us a list of the things that you think need to be done first?
Yes. For one thing, there is a program called the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Emergency Fund, which has provided temporary jobs for 250,000 people. That's going to expire at the end of this month if they don't take action. They need to take action now. They need to continue low-income tax credits that keep millions of low-income families with children out of poverty. They need to continue unemployment benefits, which will expire at the end of November. More than 3 million people were prevented from being in poverty because of the existence of those unemployment benefits. And finally, they really need to protect food stamp benefits, which also keep millions of families out of poverty.
Okay. Again, Deborah Weinstein is with the Coalition on Human Needs. Stephen Moore is a member of the editorial board and senior economic writer for the Wall Street Journal. He's author of Government, America's Number One Growth Industry. Stephen Moore, good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. Great to be with you.
You didn't hear the first half of our program, but just to review quickly, we went to Phoenix, we went to Jackson, Mississippi, we went to Baltimore. And again, probably the most striking thing all of them said was that not only were there vast increases in the number of people who need help,
right
down to food, but there were people who never expected to be there. What do you say to what Deborah Weinstein says about making sure that these safety net figures or safety net programs, rather, keep being funded?
Well, first of all, I agree entirely that these new poverty numbers are just horrific, and it's just so demoralizing to see middle-class families that never thought they would be in poverty seeing their jobs lost and incomes fall and falling into poverty, and many people losing their homes as well. And so there's no question this is a national crisis, and it's really a question, Warren, of what do we do to pick up this economy? And I'm of the belief that a lot of the things that we've done in the last couple of years haven't worked very well. Maybe we should try some new strategies to get people back to work. Because after all, Warren, we were actually seeing some real progress over the last 20 years in rising incomes and lowering poverty, and that really came to a screeching halt with this terrible recession we've been in.
The programs that Deborah Weinstein referred to, are those the ones that you're saying are strategies that haven't worked very well? It's my understanding that a lot of economists, and I believe the Census Bureau itself, if I'm not mistaken, say that if it hadn't been for those, there'd be a lot more people in poverty.
Yeah, no, there's no question that, when you have a big increase in unemployment and you've got the economy faltering like it is, that you can have these temporary programs that'll help, people from falling significantly and not having enough money to put food on the table. But I would separate those, Warren, from, an economic growth strategy that really gets jobs back. And what I was talking about is the kind of stimulus programs and the debt programs and the bailout programs that I think haven't really reversed this, terrible rise in unemployment, where we've got, 15 million unemployed people and another 10 million who can't find a full-time job. And so my priority would be, let's get America back to work with a real growth strategy.
In the meantime, though, should Congress, before it leaves Washington to go home and campaign, renew the temporary assistance for the needy families program, income tax credits for the poor, for low-income tax credit, income tax credits, the unemployment benefits, should they be extended?
Well, I'm not an expert on some of the programs that you just mentioned.
Okay.
The one I am an expert on is the unemployment insurance program. And I think one of the things that's really led to more unemployment is exactly, I know this is an issue of great disagreement among some economists, but I think the evidence is pretty clear that increasing unemployment benefits increases unemployment. If you pay people to stay unemployed, they'll stay unemployed until the benefits run out. And so I'm not a big fan of the unemployment insurance extension program. It's supposed to be a program that's supposed to be temporary, and now we're giving people up to 2 years of benefits.
when there aren't any jobs available, or so it seems from all the people we've talked to on the program, that sounds pretty harsh. If there's no jobs, what are they supposed to do?
Well, you know, I mean, what happens is that people won't take, if you provide them unemployment insurance benefits, then they won't take, you know, they have what we call a reservation wage. That is to say, Warren, people will wait until they get exactly that job that they're waiting for, and they'll stay on unemployment until they get it. If you take away some of the unemployment benefits, then what will happen is people will start to first take the first job they can get. And that's, I think, what we need to do. But it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me to continue to pay people for not working. That's just not a system that really is very just to the people who are working and paying into the system.
Stephen Moore again with the Wall Street Journal, author of Government, America's Number One Growth Industry. Heidi Schierholz is labor economist with the Economic Policy Institute. That's a think tank in Washington. Ms. Schierholz, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What's your take on what we just heard?
Well, thinking of the unemployment insurance stuff in particular, I really agree with Steve that the research shows that you can have a situation in normal times where receiving unemployment insurance can extend the time it takes you to take another job. But one thing that's important is that's actually one of the explicit goals of the program, is give people a little breathing room so that they can find a job that matches their skills and experience, because that's how the economy works best. If we have people matched well, if we're fully utilizing people's skills, that's what makes the economy run really well. But on the other hand, none of that is even relevant right now, because the reason people aren't finding jobs right now is because there aren't jobs available. So if you're in a case where their jobs are plentiful and people can have maybe some breathing room to be choosy, that's one thing. That's not the situation right now. Right now we have roughly 5 unemployed workers for every available job. If we take away unemployment insurance benefits, it will indeed make workers more desperate for work, but it won't make them more likely to find work. The work isn't out there.
So what do you do?
So we need to do more. The economic case for the government doing more, something big to create jobs, is absolutely overwhelming. The political case is another story, but the economic case is, it couldn't be more clear. One of the things that I think is not well understood is that there is a real consensus amongst economists who do forecasts and do this kind of macro work, that the recovery package actually did exactly what it was expected to do, create between 3 and 4 million jobs. The Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan office, estimates that the Recovery Act created or saved up to 5.2 million full-time equivalent jobs by the end of this quarter. While it did exactly what we expected it to do, it was never big enough. It was never big enough. Just like Steve said, it didn't turn things around. It was never big enough to do that. We need to do more to put this country back to work.
So back to Stephen Moore. Obviously, in the long term, you want to increase the strength of the economy and have the private sector create jobs. But in the meantime, again, if we have an emergency, should the government be creating more jobs than it has?
Well, you know, I think this, again, I don't see any evidence. It is true that the government spending created several million jobs, but it's also true the government spending lost more jobs than it gained. So, yeah, there might have been a gross increase of 5 million jobs gained, but there was about 7 million jobs lost, and so we came out.
How are they lost?
Because there's, you know this, Warren, from Milton Friedman, there's no such thing as a free lunch. If the government spends a dollar, that dollar has to come from somewhere. There's no tooth fairy here. The government has to either take it in taxes, or it has to borrow it, or it has to print it, and the negative effects of that spending and the way we finance the spending is greater than the positive effects. I think what we ought to do is really look at what has worked in the past. And we know government spending from the 1930s didn't work to end the Depression. We certainly had a good experiment in the last couple of years that didn't work to lower unemployment. One thing that has worked was the Reagan tax cuts back in 1981, when we saw, 8 million jobs created in the first 4 years of those tax cuts. So this is the big kind of central fight that's being fought politically now in Washington. Republicans want to cut taxes, and Democrats want more of the spending.
I think you have defined the fight. Heidi Shierholz, back to you. What do you say to the fact that if 5 million jobs were gained, 7 million jobs were lost as a result, the Reagan tax cuts worked, why not do that again?
Well, actually, right now, what we want to do is stimulate the economy. So more spending or tax cuts are both good things to do. So repealing that or making sure that the middle class tax cuts that Bush implemented don't go away at the end of the year. Those sorts of things are actually very reasonable things to do. But this issue about whether the government spending actually created net jobs is an important one to really firm up, to really figure out what went on there. And one of the key things that Steve was missing in his analysis is that there's a real difference about government spending when the economy is at full capacity and when it's not. So when the economy is going strong, we're at full employment, all the factories are going strong, and the government tries to spend stuff, there's nothing there for it to buy. There's no extra stuff. So you really can do, it really can cause problems. It really can crowd out private investment, private stuff going on. But right now, we're nowhere near that. We're nowhere near full capacity. We're nowhere near full employment. So when the government gets in there and does stuff, it's not crowding anything out. It actually has the capacity to crowd stuff in. That's this multiplier effect. That's why the government getting in there and doing real bold stuff to create jobs is exactly what we need.
Okay, this is the argument going on in Washington. Let me go back to our other guests and see how they feel about it. Beverly DeMoore, first to you at the St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance in Phoenix, Arizona. Is one person right or the other? Is there something that you'd like to see happen right away?
What I can tell you is, this is not obviously my area of expertise, but what I do know is what we see every day, and it's the families that are coming in, actually a vast majority of them are working. It's that underemployed number that has increased our distribution so much. So very clearly something needs to be done. But in Arizona, we've got, you know, 1 in 4 children are going to bed hungry, and it just it breaks your heart. So do I have the answer? No, but I can tell you when we're serving 1,000 people a day who are scared and hungry and they've never seen anything like this before, they need help.
Reverend Frank Spencer with the Stewpot Community Services in Mississippi, what's your take on all this?
I likewise am not an expert, but over 30% of our children are in the poverty level, and it does break your heart to know that historically we have been this low and we continue this low. Would love to have more jobs so their family can get out of the mess that they're in.
And Jason Perkins-Cohen with the Job Opportunities Task Force in Baltimore, do you have a policy choice?
Well, I would want to make 2 points. I think it's really important that your listeners understand when this discussion about the suggestion that people who are unemployed are just not going back to work because they'd rather stay on benefits. It's important for people to understand that when you're on unemployment insurance, you don't get your full wage back. You get a percentage of your wage. And in my experience, very few people want to sit home and collect, you know, when they could be making 100% of their wage, they would choose to make 75 or 50% of their wage, which is more like it in Maryland. That's really very few people actually make that choice. And again, I would agree with the person from EPI that you know, the jobs just aren't there. If the jobs were there, people would be going to work, but the jobs aren't there. So it's really not about cutting people off and trying to motivate them. You can't motivate someone to do something that they can't do.
Okay. And very quickly, Stephen Moore, back to you. If this is an emergency, are the proposals that you're making long-term proposals? Should we, in the meantime, take some kind of temporary steps to try to employ people? What about the WPA and during the Depression, the Works Progress Administration? We still see stuff all over the country that was built during those days with unemployed people on government wages.
Warren, I really wish that I could endorse that, and I really wish that I thought that would reduce unemployment, but it didn't work very well in the Great Depression. In fact, you know, 8 years after we started these spending programs, the unemployment rate was still 15%. So I just don't think there's any evidence that these programs work to put people back to work because of the fact that you've got to take into account when the government spends the dollar has to come from the private sector, and that causes, a kind of negative multiplier effect to the money that's been withdrawn. I think that we ought to really look at helping businesses. What's happened in Washington the last couple of years has been a kind of assault against businesses and business profits and the health care bill, and they're now talking about a big tax increase for 2011. I think one thing we should all maybe agree on is now isn't a very good time to be raising taxes on businesses, as many of the Democrats want to do.
Okay, different issue having to do with the Bush tax cuts and whether or not small businesses that are taxed as individuals might lose because they are over $250,000, but that it might damage their ability to create jobs. Heidi Sherholtz, back to you with the Economic Policy Institute. Did the WPA work? Is that something we ought to try again? Or have we found out, as Stephen Moore said, that that kind of thing just isn't going to do it?
Well, the WPA, we know, did put, I'm not sure the exact number, but hundreds of thousands of people at least back to work. It's something we haven't tried in the modern era yet. The original recovery package, it was very clear. It was about getting money into the economy. We had less than 10% of the jobs created or saved by the Recovery Act of February 2009 were public sector jobs. It really, we with the level of the crisis that we're in right now, with the persistent high unemployment, and unemployment isn't going to come down for, you know, at least the next 18 months. It's time that we start thinking very seriously about doing something like that, about really thinking hard about having the government directly create jobs. It's time that we go there.
Okay, obviously Stephen Moore is not going to go for that. I don't think a lot of Republicans are either. Deborah Weinstein, back to you. Final question, if you will, with the Coalition on Human Needs. Is there any chance at all, even if the Democrats held on to the Congress, that we would see programs like that?
Well, I don't know the answer. Again, I'm hoping that people will take this to be the state of emergency that it is. And if they do understand how much is at stake here, I am hoping that they will take a variety of actions that have multiple effects, that put money in the hands of low-income people because they can spend that money, whether it's unemployment benefits or food stamp benefits, that gets out into the economy and it does create jobs, private sector jobs. At the very least, we should be making sure that we're doing that. And we have many other things to invest in this country, renewable energy, health care. If we make those investments, there'll be more jobs, and many of them will be private sector. That will help people get out of poverty and is a decent response to the emergency we're in.
Stephen Moore, if the Republicans take over the House, perhaps the Senate as well, what would you anticipate?
Well, I think these issues we've been talking about, Warren, just in the last half hour, they're going to come front and center stage on the political arena, and there will be, you know, a real battle royale between, you know, President Obama, which supports a lot of the programs that your participants have talked about, and I think the Republicans will try to get back to sort of the tax-cutting strategy. Maybe there will be a compromise, but I agree, something has to be done because it is a tragedy what's happened with the poverty rate and the unemployment rate in this country.
Okay. We're going to leave it at that. Stephen Moore with the Wall Street Journal, Heidi Sherholtz with the Economic Policy Institute, Deborah Weinstein with the Coalition on Human Needs, and special thanks to Jason Perkins Cohen with the Job Opportunities Task Force in Baltimore, Reverend Frank Spencer with the Stewpot Community Services in Jackson, Mississippi, and Beverly DeMoor of St. Mary's Food Bank in, Alliance in Phoenix, Arizona. 33 Chilean miners trapped 2,000 feet underground got some good news today. A massive oil company drill has reached the scene, and it may be able to get to them sooner than had been expected. We'll have more on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Yesterday, Chilean President Sebastian Piñera made his fifth visit to the copper and gold mine, where 33 men have been trapped for more than 6 weeks. The novelist Isabel Allende visited two. Two tunnels already have been drilled, but they're too small for the miners to be pulled some 2,000 feet to the surface. Gideon Long is Chilean correspondent for the BBC, and thanks very much for joining us today.
No problem.
What can you tell us about this new device, this new drill bit, apparently, coming from the coal industry? And now, will it be able to drill a big enough hole to get these people out?
Well, we're told that it's much more powerful than the two drills that have been working over the past 2 weeks. It's a huge piece of equipment. I'm actually looking at it as I speak to you now. It has a 40-meter high tower which supports the drill. It's taken engineers well over a week to assemble it. They had to clear an area the size of a football pitch here at the mine just to assemble it. And it's now finally started working as of last night. We've been told that so far it's drilled through about 25 meters of rock, so still a long way to go. The miners, just to recall, are 700 meters below ground. So early days yet, but a lot of people are saying that this is the drill which will probably reach them first.
Is it drilling a big enough hole to pull them out?
It is. It works in a slightly different way from the previous two drills which have been used. Drills A and B were both drilling a pilot hole down to the miners, and then once they'd finished, the drill was brought back up to the surface and it starts widening the hole, so it's a two-stage process. That work is still going on. They're not giving up on drills A and B. But drill C works in a slightly different way. It just bores one great big hole down to the men, which should be wide enough to bring them out.
You've been there for 5 weeks yourself. You've been on this vigil. You know a lot about the families there. Tell us how they are doing now, especially now that they see this new drill coming into place.
Well, there have been lots of ups and downs for the families, as you can imagine, over the past few weeks. There's been bad news coming out when, for example, one of the drills broke. And there's been good news coming out. The past few days, there's been a lot of good news. This drill is finally working. Today is the first day that the engineers are drilling with all three drills, digging three separate escape shafts for the men. So the families have been reacting to that news. For the most part, they're positive. I think the way they see this is this. These men survived for 17 days with hardly any food and water and no contact with the outside world. And the families say if they could survive that, they can survive anything. Okay, so now they have food, they have water, they're in a much better position, things are being sent down to them. If they can survive those first few days, which they did, they can survive for another few weeks until they can be brought to the surface. That's the attitude that the families have.
So the mine collapsed. It was 17 days before it was discovered that they were there in this room that I take it is about the size of a small office. It's not very big at all. What about them and the work that's been done by scientists from NASA and others who have experience with a lot of people in a small space?
Yeah, the space is not so much of an issue, I have to say, because although they're in a small shelter, they can move around to some extent within the tunnels within the mine. So they have an area around 200 meters long where they can move. And they've divided that space up so they have living quarters, they have areas where they're working, they're going to be clearing away some of the rubble which falls down during the drilling process. So they have, they're not crammed into one small shelter, they have a little bit of area to move about. But obviously, it's not ideal conditions, and psychologists have been talking to the miners. It's been amazing just as the weeks have gone on, how they've developed a system to speak to the miners, to see the miners, to send things down to them. There's now a fiber optic cable running down from the rescue team offices here, right down 700 meters into the ground, so that the relatives and the rescue team can have permanent contact with the miners, not only by telephone, but they can see them. So we've seen all these videos coming out of the miners. Things like MP3 players, tiny little video recorders have been sent down to them, so they have some sort of entertainment. And, of course, food and water. So, obviously not ideal conditions for them. They've been down there for over 40 days now, but things are at least reaching them. There are things being sent down to them to keep them occupied, to keep them entertained, to stop them going crazy while the rescue operation continues.
What about cigarettes and alcohol?
Well, that's been a contentious issue. To start off with, the medics here who are overseeing the operation said that the miners shouldn't be sent cigarettes. That was for ventilation reasons, above all. They said that if the guys were smoking down there, then it would obviously the air quality would deteriorate in the mine. That has since been resolved. They've managed to drill another borehole down to the men, which they're using for ventilation. So the air quality is improving, and they've started sending cigarettes down to them. They've been rationed a couple of packets a day, which are to be divided between them, but they are now getting cigarettes. Alcohol, however, has been banned right from the start of this operation, and the government has been very firm on that. As you may know, this weekend, the past weekend just gone, It was Independence Day here in Chile, and it's a day where most people celebrate with a glass of Chilean red wine. There was a lot of speculation that the miners might be sent some wine, but in the end, the government said this is an alcohol-free zone, and it will remain so even on Independence Day.
Are you impressed by the response by the government? There was a lot of criticism at the outset that mine didn't have enough escape shafts, and that's the reason that they got trapped down there. What about the effort that's been made since?
I'd say the effort that's been made since has been fairly good, and that's what we heard from the guys who came from NASA. These guys obviously have a huge amount of experience of dealing with space missions, sending astronauts into isolation for weeks and weeks on end. The guys from NASA came down here, and they really gave the Chilean government a clean bill of health in terms of what they were doing for the men. When they went back, the guys from NASA said that the government was doing everything they should be doing. They had everything right in terms of the diet the men was having, in terms of the psychological help they were receiving. So, yes, the government does seem to have done a fairly good job, and that's been reflected in the opinion polls in here in Chile. It's given President Sebastián Piñera, and particularly his mining minister, Lawrence Goulburn, a big boost in the opinion polls.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it at that. Gideon Long, again, with the BBC, has been at the face of that mine since the miners were discovered. We'll hear more from you, I hope, in days to come, and thanks for being with us today. Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Karen Radziner and Andrea Brody. Our technical director is Phil Richards. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.